Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Will your descendants still be driving cars? Will they want what we want? What if civilization takes a dive, but then comes back with the same energy-hungry drive? The award-winning physicist, Professor Robert B. Laughlin, has thought this through deeply. I'm Alex Smith, with plenty of questions about his vision of how we will power the future. I hate to agree with you, but I think that gas is really problematic. First of all, fracked gas, there have been studies out showing that there's enough leakage in the whole process, including the delivery and storage system, that you might as well be burning coal. So it's not that great a solution anyway once you start fracking for it. And the second thing is that they have to keep drilling more and more and more and more wells, because gas runs out so quickly. It doesn't just sort of decline the way an oil well does. It's there and then it's not there, and that could happen to the whole darn industry. So we may be in for a shock on this gas dependence.
Might. That anecdotal rumors that I'm hearing, yes, are that the fracked wells peak more rapidly than the traditional deep wells do. Traditional deep wells of gas are like oil wells. They have long peaking tails. But it's very hard to back up this this short peaking story with data because the industry is too young. So I think it's right, but I'm not 100% sure. Fracking has opposition, political opposition from various sources, and you're quite right. There are environmental issues, and there's how much methane you're putting in the air, and so on. And so that's a conversation we have, whether you're going to have laws that regulate the use of natural gas. Those are conversations that are now happening. But in North America, at least, what has happened is that natural gas is so cheap that nobody's fracking for it anymore. They can't make money. So the fracking activity for gas has basically come to a screeching halt because the market price of gas went down to one half of what it should have been, what it was before, and the drillers can't make money. All those people have now gone off into what's called the tight oil market, and they are trying to go back to old wells that have pooped out and use these new technologies to pull out the remaining oil from the reservoirs there. Because of the political lay of the land, this is something I think that's just going to work out, and we'll see. I mean, I don't know, maybe there's infinite gas in the ground and they can just keep drilling and everybody will be energy independent forever because of the gas. I suppose it's possible. But my money says that this is a fantasy. My guess is that it's a fantasy, and what will happen is that there will be a 10 to 20-year peaking tail associated with these new technologies that will then poop out, and then sort of towards the middle of the century, one will be back to where one was in the early 90s.
Well, in the end, however many years from now, your future humans have electricity and cars and airplanes simply because we love them so much. And as an environmentalist, I was really annoyed by such blatant assumptions until I came to think, well, you're creating a kind of public mirror. That is what we all think. At least that's the way the government acts. And if we're honest, even environmentalists, they buy cars they hope will last 20 years without too many repair bills. So maybe it's time to come clean a little bit, Robert Laughlin. Is this book, Powering the Future, a little bit like Jonathan Swift's essay, A Modest Proposal? Are you baiting us a little?
I don't think so. I'm asking people who are really worried, you know, who love the Earth as I do, to think realistically about what's going to happen. There are a lot of people, especially in the 20 crowd, you know, the student crowd, who think that the world is coming to an end and that you have to make drastic changes in governance in order to stop it. Now, what I try to tell these folks is that after you've lived a long time, what you see is that the human nature comes out of the box. You don't program that. It's people come out of the box where they are, and so you're great-grandchildren who don't exist yet are going to be like you, and they're going to love life, and they're going to, when they do this living, they're going to be a burden on the Earth just like you are, and they're going to have to make environmental compromises just like you do, and this is a conversation of all eternity. In other words, you're not going to pass a law tomorrow and save the Earth. Saving the Earth is an ongoing process that will go thousands and millions of years into the future. Every generation that's born will have to make economic compromises between how well it lives and how much you protect the Earth. There's no quick fix. I want everybody to think about the future in terms of both natural law and the laws of economics. When I talk to student audiences around the world, I typically ask them three questions. I ask them, in this time in the future, after all the fossil fuel is gone, will people drive cars? Will people drive flying airplanes? And will the electricity come on? And it turns out that almost universally around the world, the answer is more or less the same. About 70% of the people say that folks will drive cars. And I ask them why. And it beats around the bush for 10 minutes, and then somebody, usually a young woman, says quietly, because they want them. Whereupon, we have a conversation about economics. The fact that some of the things that are destined to happen will occur simply because people want them. And that's something, when you're thinking about actions you must do to save the Earth, that's something you have to think about. Okay? People who are not born yet are going to do things just because they want them. The airplane conversation comes down similarly, about 70%. And there, I ask them, great, why? It's the same answer. And then I ask, well, what's going to fuel the airplanes? And then we have all sorts of silly conversations about sunlight and so forth. And then we hit on the important thing, which is that, well, present-day jet fuel has the most energy per volume and weight allowed by physical law. And so if those people of the future are going to be flying in airplanes, then we're not going to have a carbon-free future. What we're going to have instead is a new industry that grows up that makes the kinds of fuels that you use today from parts that are lying around. This, of course, doesn't pull any more carbon out of the earth anymore, so there's no CO2 issue there. But there is a matter that you can't demonize carbon completely, per se, when you're thinking about the future, because there will always be carbon-based fuels in the future because they're optimal. And then the final thing is the electricity coming on, and that's an important matter which has to do with politics. That is to say that there are pricing things likely to happen in the future that are dictated by what people will vote for. That means that in particular, that this fight I mentioned about the solar energy versus nuclear taking place, there probably isn't any way to avert that because the political process demands that power be cheap. So once we have that conversation, then we can go and talk about the getting from here to there.
Of course, you're presuming we will have a working political decision where people can vote for things. If we get knocked back far enough on our keisters, we might not be able to make those decisions, especially the big-scale decisions, but we can debate that. Well, as we wrap up, Robert Laughlin, is there other things that you would like to mention or talk about?
You know, when you write a book, you try to talk about everything you can think of in the prose itself. It's not the world's best medium because people can't talk back to you. In this particular case, the references in the back made feedback from people difficult. Okay, that people are afraid to talk to me about it because it's got too much gravity. So I guess my answer to you and your listeners would be that I am not a lion. I love talking about this stuff. I'm as worried as anybody, and I'm trying to find what you might say is the way of the engineer. I am a person who looks at a terrible problem and asks, how do you fix it? And I'm a man also who answers his email. So anybody who wants to talk to me about it, feel free.
I'll challenge you, listeners, should you buy a book knowing it will irritate you or may make you think, and what if it educates you along the way? That is Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilization of Tomorrow, by Stanford physics professor and Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin. And he's been our guest on Radio EcoShock. You can find links to the book and other notes in my blog at ecoshock.info. Robert, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. This is my seventh year producing radio that matters for nonprofit college and community stations around the world. You can help keep the big ball of earwaves going by offering your support at our website, ecoshock.org. Now, back to one of our specialties here, keeping up to date with the latest climate science. As Robert W. Service wrote, there are strange things done neath the midnight sun. You are about to learn something new going on, powerful but unseen, in the melting far north. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. In the past decade, satellites, scientists, and Aboriginals looking at the Arctic find bigger areas without snow cover for longer periods. Arctic heating is greater there than anywhere in the lower temperate zones where most of us live. A huge portion of planet Earth is frozen, we thought permanently, and calling it permafrost. It's beginning to thaw, and we have fresh science showing new pathways for greenhouse gases that might enter the atmosphere. Just out is this paper titled, Surface Exposure to Sunlight Stimulates CO2 Release from Permafrost Soil Carbon in the Arctic. It was published online in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on January 4, 2013. We have the lead author on the line, Rose M. Corey, assistant professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Rose, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I think we have to begin by describing the changes in the landscape that's happening in the Arctic, whether it's Alaska or Canada or Siberia. What is it like there in the area you've been studying?
Well, what we've been looking at are these thermokarst failures, which are giant sinkholes you can think of in the tundra. So what we expected in the past, you know, when we pictured the permafrost warming and the ice melting, is we thought that the permafrost might kind of thaw quietly in place with that ice below ground just, you know, kind of melting. And what's happening increasingly is that ice, that those ice-rich soils, that ice is like structure holding the ground up. And when that ice melts and thaws and disappears, that the structure in the ground is gone. And that causes a land surface subsidence or what we call a thermokarst failure. And if the ground slope is large, that can be this really large, you know, sinkhole where then all of this previously frozen carbon is now mixed up and exposed to the relative warmth and sunlight at Earth's surface.
Okay, well, listeners, thermokarst is spelled with a K in there, and I have seen a video where a Russian researcher was demonstrating these, and there were like puddles or ponds that were kind of first raised up and then falling down all across these treeless flats of Siberia, and that's what you're talking about, is it?
Yes, exactly, yes.
All right. Well, now we've been told there's more carbon in those frozen northern soils than already exists in our atmosphere. Let's step back a little bit. Where did all that plant life come from?
Well, it comes exactly from what you say, vegetation. So plants, as they grow, they take that carbon from the atmosphere. So, you know, through photosynthesis, they take carbon dioxide and turn it into organic carbon, which they store in living organisms, you know, in the plant. And then as plants die and decompose, that organic matter can then be, you know, returned back to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, and that process we call respiration. But say when it's cold and wet or frozen, as it is in the Arctic most of the year, that decay process is very slow. And so you get an accumulation of that organic matter over time.
So this might be over thousands of years or longer even?
Yes, that's right.
Your paper suggests that the release of carbon dioxide or methane is not just a simple process where compact plant life is being exposed and then it somehow just evaporates into the atmosphere. There's a complex process taking place. Could you talk to us about that process?
Yes. Basically, as soon as carbon is unfrozen, bacteria or microbes in the soil can start basically eating or consuming that carbon and turning it into carbon dioxide. That's the process of respiration that I was talking about. But the thermokarst failures, again, they kind of change the trajectory of the debate of what we think is going to happen. Because, again, once that permafrost soil is warmed up and unfrozen enough, bacteria can start converting that carbon to carbon dioxide. But again, what's happening is that these sinkholes, they mix up all of this carbon, and they sinkholes bring this carbon to the Earth's surface where there's sunlight. And sunlight are photochemical reactions initiated by the ultraviolet portion of sunlight change the chemistry of the organic carbon. And that those changes in the chemical composition of that organic carbon stimulate the bacteria's ability to turn that carbon into carbon dioxide. So in other words, taking that stuff from the dark below ground and giving it a little bit of sunlight means that more of it will be converted by bacteria to carbon dioxide.
And I guess that's some of the big news of this paper. It's almost like there's a new actor, sunlight itself.
That's right, yes.
And did I read this correctly in the paper, and I may have misunderstood this, but it seemed like you were also saying that sunlight itself can release greenhouse gases directly, even without those microbes. Did I get that wrong?
That's correct. No, there can be what we call direct mineralization or photochemical reactions initiated by sunlight and convert the organic carbon directly to carbon dioxide without bacteria being involved, yes.
That role of sunlight combined with microbes and water, it's a bit difficult to understand because I thought bright sunlight might actually inhibit microbial action. So how is that working out?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly if you take a, you know, water sample with bacteria in it and, you know, say a very thin layer of water in a petri dish and put it out in sunlight, then yes, you will kind of fry the bacteria basically. But that UV light from sunlight that is, you know, directly harmful to bacteria, it's absorbed by the organic carbon in the water. So the organic carbon is basically like sunscreen for aquatic organisms, and it's that process of absorbing that UV portion of sunlight that alters its chemistry and breaks the organic carbon, say, from larger molecules that maybe can't get across the bacterial membrane into smaller ones that bacteria can more easily or more readily respire to carbon dioxide.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Rose Corey from the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She's part of a team trying to unravel what happens as the massive Arctic permafrost begins to melt due to global warming. Corey, I gather you did your base studies in Alaska. Does it matter whether the newly released organic matter is in these thermokarst ponds or whether it's in big streams or in muddy rivers? What did you find out about rivers, for example, on Alaska's North Slope?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that's one, the variability or the potential variability in the response is one thing that we wanted to address in this study, which is why we looked at the three different types of thermokarst failures. They're, you know, we classify them, you know, based on whether they're glacial thaw slumps or erosional gullies, for example. And we sampled these different classes of thermokarst failures on landscapes of different ages in the Arctic, say from younger landscapes formed about 10,000 years ago to much older landscapes formed 2 million years before present, because we expected that these thermokarst failures on these different age landscapes would have very different soil and water chemistry, say, for example, like pH or water conductivity. And that's exactly what we found, is that there was large variability in soil and soil water chemistry across these different sites. But what was consistent was the effect of sunlight. So no matter what the soil chemistry was, when this previously frozen carbon is exposed to sunlight at our surface, bacteria are better able to respire it to carbon dioxide. And that means that our results are robust. They're not limited to one type of soil or one type of landscape surface.
Well, I think listeners have to keep in mind this is the land where we can get 24 hours of sunlight practically. I mean, a very powerful sun in the summertime at least. Well, Rose Corey, the climate models suggest the Arctic will become wetter and wetter in the coming decades and maybe centuries. The tundra is going to become almost washed over. Will that increase in rains affect the findings that you're looking at?
Sure, in several probably complicated ways, but probably if it does get wetter, that will probably further drive the transfer of this thermokarst carbon or permafrost carbon from land to water, again, where photochemical reactions may be important. And because it's the UV portion of sunlight, it has to be pretty cloudy, we found in the Arctic, for these photochemical reactions to be shut down. And they're certainly slower when there's less UV, of course, but it's not as simple as, you know, a sunny day versus a partly cloudy or, you know, partly rainy day.
All right. And I'm going to quote now a sentence from your paper developed by your team, and it's worrying me. You conclude, quote, "Our results suggest that photostimulation will rapidly, days to months, increase conversion to CO2 by an additional 40% or more in thawed and released sea compared with that remaining in the dark, and that photostimulated bacterial use of this carbon in natural streams may equal or exceed its degradation in the dark alone." So you're talking about a 40% increase when sunlight is involved. That's quite a bit, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, what does that mean to us? What are the importance and consequences of this finding?
Well, again, like I said before, I think it alters the debate on the role of the Arctic in future climate change. So we know how much carbon is stored in these permafrost soils. And again, that's about twice as much carbon as is currently in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. And what we don't know is how and how fast that frozen carbon will be turned into carbon dioxide. And our results show that once this carbon is exposed at the surface, it's more likely that it will be turned into carbon dioxide and released to the atmosphere, where it can then drive and further reinforce warming.
It is a positive feedback loop then.
That's right, yes.
Another one in the Arctic, because there's quite a few there. If you'll hang in with me for a minute, I want to describe an event that's happened several times and then ask you whether this applies to your paper. I recall reporting on a very odd event in the Arctic in 1988 and again in late summer 2005, following some high temperatures and bright sunshine. Canadian researchers on Ellesmere Island found masses of plants, whole landscapes in fact, became detached from the permafrost below, and they slid down into river valleys. Some rivers were blocked. They formed new lakes. Entire ridges appeared. The geography was changed. And I'm wondering if a macro event like that, would that also change the amount of carbon that's going to be released according to the processes that you've studied?
Yes, if I understand you correctly, if there's sounds like kind of a landslide and, you know, movement of carbon, yes, anything that would bring, say, deeper carbon, whether or not it's frozen, but, you know, bring deeper soil carbon into surface waters would facilitate the loss of that carbon to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide through the kinds of sunlight-driven reactions that we are looking at.
Well, Rose Corey, can you talk about the science that you think still needs to be done?
Sure. Well, in my specific area of research, looking at, you know, the chemistry of this organic carbon, we really need to understand how and why bacteria prefer one kind of, you know, molecule of organic carbon over another. This dissolved organic carbon, or the organic carbon that's coming out of these soils that we study, I like to say it's the most complex mixture on Earth. And, you know, it's really the mixture of the decay products of life, of material that was once formerly living. And so you take any water sample, and there are thousands and thousands of organic molecules. And we don't know enough about the chemistry to be able to predict which of those molecules will be returned to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide on a time scale that's relevant for carbon cycling. And that requires, you know, work from, you know, organic geochemists and aquatic microbiologists, as well as other people contributing too.
I know the public isn't really concerned about permafrost melting yet, and yet it could really, well, ruin our climate and ruin our lives if it gets out of control and we don't even know about it.
Yes, it's very odd or jarring, I'd say, to work in the Arctic every summer and, you know, to see the thermokarsts forming, to look at how they're evolving, say, over time, as well as, you know, look at other changes in the Arctic and then come back home to North Carolina and no one has any idea. And, you know, pictures and movies are great, but I think we need to do a lot more of that. You know, I tell people, I show movies of these thermokarst failures and I say, you know, what would it be like, or how would the debate be different if, you know, we had buildings or homes built on this kind of ground? And, you know, I think there just aren't enough people yet that are, you know, that can make the impact direct in their lives, such that it just doesn't hit home enough.
Right. It's out of sight and out of mind. You've just heard from Rose M. Corey, Assistant Professor in Environmental Sciences and Engineering at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She's the lead author in the new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Its title is Surface Exposure to Sunlight Stimulates CO2 Release from Permafrost Soil Carbon in the Arctic. You can Google that to find out more or check out a few links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Rose, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. In coming programs, we'll cover action in the big picture and ways a million longing hearts can steer in a different direction, including me, including you. In the meantime, we can always follow the lead of the artists. This summer, a sustainability-based electro-swing ukulele show about permaculture is touring the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. They are from Australia, and they're called the Formidable Vegetable Sound System. Get the details at their website at permaculturesongs.com. Here is Formidable Vegetable Sound System with No Such Thing as Waste.
Was a little boy, I liked to catch the rain, while people all around my town watched it flow right down the drain. But 'cause our little shed in the bush wasn't on the main, the only water we had to use was in a tank caught from the rain. 'Cause there's no such thing as waste, only stuff in the wrong place. No, there's no such thing as waste. Misusing water's a disgrace. Moved to the city, rented a house on my way to buy a bed. Saw one lying on the side of the road, so I took that one instead. And also found a fridge, a couch, and a big old plasma screen, and the biggest pile of thrown out stuff that I had ever seen. But there's no such thing as waste. Oh no, only stuff in the wrong place. Yeah, that's right, there's no such thing as waste. That old landfill is a disgrace. Found out that diesel cars can run on veggie fat. Bought a truck and hit the road, smelling like fish and chips. I rescued piles of wasted oil from the back of restaurants. I'd be a fool if I bought my fuel when there's oil nobody wants. 'Cause no such thing as waste. Oh no, only stuff in the wrong place. Yeah, I said there's no such thing as waste. That old idea's gotta be replaced. Now we gotta refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle. Refuse, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle. Now I get my things out of garbage bins and I compost every crumb. I save my seeds and eat my weeds and feed the leftovers to your mum. Gonna build a house from the rubbish tip, gonna keep this planet clean. Reuse ideas that have been around for years to live within its means. 'Cause there's no such thing as waste. Oh no, only stuff in the wrong place. Squeedy and bitty, bitty. I said there's no such thing as waste.